Politically Incorrect.
Correct.
This is Politically Incorrect with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson on TNT Radio.
And good morning, good evening, good night, good afternoon, wherever you may be around the world. It's great to have you with us on Politically Incorrect this afternoon. I'm Mike Tennessee, and with me is my very dear friend, Richard Carson, whose mother never called him Dick. Our special guest today, Richard, is, as you know, Dr. Peter Ridd. Dr. Ridd is quite a controversial Queensland academic, or was, we'll come back to that. He's a senior research fellow at the Institute of Public Affairs and is leading the Project for Real Science. He's a former professor and head of physics at James Cook University in Townsville. His consultancy work while at the university resulted in the development of specialist instrumentation for measuring aspects of water quality, with the profits used to fund student scholarships and research projects. Now, Dr. Ridd has published hundreds of papers, well, certainly in the hundreds of papers on international science in international science journals, and he supervised many successful PhD students. One book that might be remembered is his work called Reef Heresy, Research and the Great Barrier Reef. And it's the Great Barrier Reef, which we've spoken about last week, and we're going to talk about it again this week. But let me just make a couple more comments before I hand over to Richard. Peter made comments about a lead coral researcher once and said some organisations could no longer be trusted. He was sacked for those comments by the University of James Cook in 2018. He argued it was illegal. He won in the Federal Circuit Court, which was the court of first level, I suppose you'd call it, but was then overturned on appeal. Welcome to the program, Dr. Ridd. I'm going to ask Richard to say a few more words about you, and then I'll let him take the running. We've got a lot to talk about, and I know you're keen to inform us.
Thank you, Mike. Peter, I assume you're there. I don't see you, but that, I'm going to run the theory that you're just behind the microphone there. Yep. I followed your travails, for want of a word, since you were set aside by the James Cook University, for want of a nicer thing to say. And like hundreds of thousands of, I'll call ourselves, decent people, I was astounded at what was done to you and why it was done and the ramifications thereof. But if we could sort of open the batting, and we'll talk about different parts of your last 3 or 4 years of chaos, for want of a word. We were talking with Dr. Karen Benn last week, and some of the things that, you know, have caused you to be put where you are was your questioning of, I'm going to call it, the rude good health of the Barrier Reef, as opposed to what is then levelled against you. Can you elaborate on where you were standing on the position of the reef, and then we'll work our way through what's happened since that very, you know, obvious misjustice, in my opinion?
Well, if we look at today, the latest statistics on the Great Barrier Reef, which measures the amount of coral done by the Australian Institute of Marine Science every year for 35 years, puts the amount of coral on the Great Barrier Reef as high as it's ever been. So despite all the bad news about bleaching over the last few years, the Great Barrier Reef has never had more coral since records began. But if we go back to what triggered my little problem with the university, which ended up with me being fired, I essentially blew the whistle on a very famous set of photographs which looked at a reef around an island near Bowen. One photograph was in 1895, showing beautiful coral reefs coming out of the water at low tide. And another picture, sort of supposedly today sometime, showing supposedly the same reef with an absolute barren wasteland. And my own work had demonstrated that, and they were blaming sediment from farmers for killing this reef. And my own work had shown that this just couldn't be possible. So I sent my guys down to look at this reef and say, well, tell us if there's actually any coral here. And, of course, they came back and they demonstrated that the reef around that stone island was absolutely beautiful, and that this stuff, this these set of photographs, which were being used by all the big science organisations, were utter junk. And I basically said I wanted to know why they were misleading the public and what quality assurance systems that they were using in order to draw these conclusions. And that was the first trigger for what was called the first censure against me.
So with those, well, I'll call them fictitious photographs, you know, what was the agenda behind running something to say, oh, the reef's no good here, when in effect they were probably presenting something that was totally false?
Well, this is a good question. Why is it that a lot of the scientists have been so keen to portray the reef as being in a terrible shape? There's a lot of ideology in the environmental science organisation. Unlike problems, say, in Big Pharma, which the previous program was actually talking about, where there's a financial gain, I think it's mostly ideological in the environmental sciences. So a lot of people go into the environmental sciences because they're worried about the world. Right. And I think that they leave their scientific impartiality behind and they start playing politics. So that's one of the problems that occurs. And they end up just not worrying about dotting the I's and crossing the T's scientifically.
Peter, it's Mike here. You published an article back in May this year called "The Reef Is Not Dead." And in that, you were talking about this very thing, I think, weren't you? The Great Barrier Reef Marine Protection Authority had released a report which effectively said that coral deaths were happening. And you said in your article that it should have waited until some of the surveys from divers were completed before it went ahead and published that sort of material. And that's exactly what you're suggesting now, isn't it? That people are going ahead and publishing material which simply cannot be supported by proper evidence.
Exactly. So this latest one is one of dozens of cases where what happens is something bad is happening to the reef. In this case, there was a bit of bleaching happening, which is a totally natural phenomenon. And they make out as though this is a total disaster. With bleaching, you've got to wait to see whether the coral recovers, and that can take a couple of months. Now, in fact, we've been back to some of those reefs personally, and our co-workers, Jennifer Marahasi, and reefs that were classified as severely or very severely bleached have ended up we've been able to demonstrate that the coral has come through almost utterly unscathed. So one of the problems with coral reefs is that periodically, especially due to cyclones or hurricanes, you lose a lot of coral. And so the institutions will say, oh, we've lost all this coral, and they forget to tell you over the next few years how well it recovers. Or in this case, it bleached, it didn't even die. Within a couple of months, it's back to completely normal. So there's a degree of opportunism when there's something bad happening to the reef, and bad things happen to every organism, every ecosystem, but they never mention the recovery. And this is one of the reasons why I essentially said that these institutions could no longer be trusted.
Now, on that point of trust, there's a bit of a lack of trust just about in every avenue of life, unfortunately, at the moment, whether we're talking media, pharmaceuticals, medical, and obviously the very points that you're referring to. The decision to try to mislead the population at large about the reef, then that does that lead into excessive amounts of monies going via the way of the James Cook University and the various sections for nefarious activities other than saving it?
Exactly. So, and it's not just James Cook University, it's Australian Institute of Marine Science, the CSIRO, every other university. So at the very highest levels of those institutions, there is a financial incentive to portray the reef as in as bad a condition as they can so that they can get screw more money out of the government. So Scott Morrison's government gave another $1 billion to the reef over 10 years.
That's amazing.
Happens again and again.
So how do we go about stopping this from happening? How do you get to the ear of governments to say, well, that money could be better spent on real science rather than to organisations which are actually bludgeoning the media outlets and putting out information which perhaps is not quite true?
The problem is that you've got to convince the population that these institutions are indeed unreliable, because the politicians ultimately have to follow the public's opinion. Now, look, there's no doubt I've spoken to a lot of politicians over the last few years, and quite a few of them realise exactly what is going on, that they are being blackmailed by the institutions to hand over cash on the cause of the Great Barrier Reef, even though it's not particularly badly damaged. But their reality is if they even admit to that in public, they will be absolutely crucified by the mainstream media. So the essential problem that I have is that I'm saying, look, the Great Barrier Reef is in wonderful condition, but the corollary of that is that, well, then the public institutions, the scientific institutions, must be totally untrustworthy. So the public, the proverbial man in the street has this horrible choice. They've got to either believe that the reef is dead and the institutions are reliable, or that the reef is fine and the institutions are utterly untrustworthy. And most people don't want to believe that the institutions are untrustworthy because it's too horrible to even contemplate that.
Well, Peter, I think it might be about time that we started to understand that so many levels of what we give our beliefs of decency to are taking an enormous advantage of that decency while carrying on in a with their nefarious activities. So probably those politicians that you've spoken to need to have a little bit of gumption and stand up and start to articulate and have the capacity to take information that you've got, Dr. Karen Benscott, and actually articulate the facts versus the fiction.
I entirely agree. And good. I've actually done a lot of work on what's the best way to do that. So for a politician to stand up and say, oh, look, I agree with Peter Ridd and Karen Ben that the reef is fine, they might get into a bit of trouble with that. But all you have to do is say, look, there's some really strange things going on here. You know, the Ames data says the reef has got record high coral cover, and yet the institutions say that there's been these big bleaching events over the last few years and all the corals died. And I'm a little bit confused. So I think we should have a little bit of quality assurance here. We're going to employ some scientists to do an audit on this so we can know what's right and what's wrong, so we spend our money in the right way. You're not coming out, you know, hard and fast as a skeptic on the reef. You're just asking for a bit more checking. And I think that almost any reasonable person would think that would be a very sensible way to go about it. That this person, this politician, isn't saying that Ames is utterly untrustworthy on some things, which I believe they are, though they're very good on other things. But they're just asking for some quality assurance. Why would anybody think that asking for quality assurance was a bad thing?
And that's the very point, is have a decent, open and transparent discussion with probably almost two separate teams of inquisitors, because if you just let one mob run it, they're going to come up with the answer that they're currently coming up with and not be plain and totally transparent with what the facts are, because people who have businesses up there, you know, they'll openly say if they get given a microphone where they go out on tours and whatever else, that the reef's in very good condition and they're there every other day.
Precisely. And you're dead right about making sure there's a debate. I mean, what happened to me was I said, look, there's some major problems with the quality assurance systems. You guys have claimed there was no coral on this reef and there's beautiful coral on the reef. Mm-hmm. Should we look at the quality assurance? Now, what happened was that I was hit with charges by the university, which was the first thing that led up to me being fired. What should have happened was the university should have said to these complaints, well, look, Ridd has said you don't have quality assurance. He said that you reckon there was no coral there and he's proven there isn't. Why don't you take up the debate with Ridd and demonstrate to him how you were right? But instead what happened is the university comes down and basically silences me, or at least tries to silence me, and ultimately fires me. So this is one example where you know there must be a problem with the science, and people are very uneasy about that, by the way. They're very uneasy with people being silenced, even if they disagree with the arguments that they've got. But it's demonstrating that if the institutions are not allowing a debate, then what are they hiding? You know, especially in this case, where the person was ultimately removed from that position.
Well, that's the point, isn't it, Peter? My recollection is, Mike here, my recollection is that you lost the High Court hearing because of what was contained within the work contract you had with the university, which effectively, according to you and others, kills any academic freedom of speech. And it was the contract, which was effective in law, which meant your demise. But I think it's true to say, isn't it, from your opinion at least, that the university was never right, proper, decent, moral, or in line with public expectations as to how it should behave. It was merely an employment issue rather than what you were saying against others who were saying something different.
I think there's no doubt that almost everybody, including my academic opponents, people who would disagree with me scientifically, almost all of them think that the university acted in a completely despicable manner, and certainly not in a way that we'd expect the university to behave. Now, when it comes to the actual High Court decision, that was actually quite interesting because it was sort of a two-edged sword. But on one hand, they said that the university acted unlawfully in censuring me for the Stone Island pictures and the various other things. So they said that the university should never have censured me for my academic comments. But it said that, so it was very supportive of free speech and what we call academic freedom.
Well, Richard's reminding me, Peter, that we have to go to a break, but we'll come back to this after the break. We have to break for a couple of minutes.
No worries.
Stay with us and we'll come back to it.
George Eliason on TNT Radio.
You and George have been supporting former President Trump throughout the Democrats' persecution of the man. How's he holding up right now?
I believe that today it's obvious, is clear to everyone how he's been nothing more, nothing less than a target, a political threat because of his honest agenda. We have assisted to a massive witch hunt against Donald Trump. We have assisted to weaponization of institution. We have assisted to defamation, massive defamation, for some even vote fraud. So we know that if today Trump is back, he's back stronger than ever because he emerged from the dust that has been created by his administration, Biden.
George Eliason on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I view Al Sharpton as a poverty pimp.
Terrorism from white supremacy is the most lethal threat to the homeland.
I walk outside every day in fear of white supremacy right here in the middle of the hood. Okay, yeah, right.
My grandparents had a cross burned on their property. We were slaves in the past. We're free now.
I never seen a white supremacist in my life. Never, and it can't point to one. Where the hell are they? I wish somebody would introduce me to a white supremacist. I would like to talk to them and take pictures with them because I never seen one in my life.
Biden says that the country is systematically racist. You know, I almost want to look at him and say, haven't you been the system for the last 50 years?
He's the one that sponsored the 1994 crime bill, which unequivocally basically targeted black men in black neighborhoods.
The polarization. The left versus right, the black versus white.
Pro-choice against pro-life.
I work for Black Lives Matter. I'm sorry that I scared you.
People have had to make it like they're apologizing for their whiteness.
And could you just please apologize for, you know, for your white privilege?
What's more disheartening to me is that those who are within the black community are allowing for that to take place.
So really what we're dealing with is a cultural Marxism that Joe Biden and all the rest from the left were trying to inculcate into our society.
Well, you were once the oppressor, so now I must be the oppressor. You don't avenge evil for evil.
It's okay to say disparaging things against white people. Our former president, Barack Obama, said it, you know, about old white men are a problem. Except when it comes time for him to fly around on their airplanes and ride around on their yachts or be their next door neighbors or endorse them for president like Joe Biden, then old white men are okay. This is their last gasp.
What do progressive socialists really want?
Watch Systematic Deception at SalemNow.com.
Democracy in Action. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And you're back on Politically Incorrect with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson. Just before you lead the questioning of Dr. Peter Ridd, Richard, I was thinking we should point out to our international listeners, of which there are many, that we're talking about James Cook University, which is situated in Townsville in Queensland in Australia. Now, that's within a whistle's throw of the Great Barrier Reef, which, as everybody knows, is one of the seven natural wonders of the world. And the High Court that we were speaking about is the High Court of Australia, which is Australia's highest court. In other words, that's where it stops. We no longer have to go to the Privy Council in England. The High Court's where the buck stops and where the court appeals stop. Over to you, Richard.
Well, I'll come back to the reef in a roundabout way, if I may, Peter, with regards the health of the reef. And then we sort of get into the climate change debate and temperatures and weather and all sorts of things. And as we were hearing from Dr. Karen Benn last week, you know, the reef was supposedly being destroyed by the farming community, but I don't think that's right either. I think that's a very, very, very minuscule effect on the reef, if there was any, which there doesn't appear to be. Your observation of temperatures and the benefits of temperature with regards coral reefs, that would be a positive rather than a negative, wouldn't it?
Without doubt. So, you know, all the corals, or most of the corals that live on the Great Barrier Reef also live in the warmer water around Papua New Guinea, Thailand, the Philippines, in an area that they call the Coral Triangle because it's the most diverse area of coral, and they grow faster there by about 10 to 20%. And all the work, you know, there's been dozens of experiments that demonstrate that as you go a degree or two warmer, corals grow faster. Corals have this brilliant ability to change the symbiotic algae that lives inside them to cope with temperature changes. So bleaching is actually that. Bleaching is when the coral chucks out the symbiotic algae that lives inside it, and in most cases, it will then bring back the symbiotic algae after the bleaching event, after a hot weather event. In many cases, it will bring back a different species of symbiotic algae, which allows it to cope with better, with higher or lower temperatures. So unlike most organisms, for corals to deal with climate change, whether it's human or natural, all they need to do is shuffle the algae within them, and they can deal with 1, 2, 3, 4 degrees hotter. Almost no other organism has that amazing ability. So they can change their ability to deal with temperature in a couple of months, whereas almost any other organism has to go through many cycles and generations of natural selection, birth and death, in order to change its DNA. Corals don't need to do that. Corals like it hot. There's no reason to expect that corals are going to be particularly badly damaged by climate change, and the data clearly demonstrates that as well.
So, and is there something in the question of whether or not aerial photographs properly show how the health of the coral is, if, for instance, the photographs obviously are taken from high up and therefore they probably don't get some of the corals in picture that are further or deeper in the ocean? But is there anything in that?
Exactly. This is some of the work that Jennifer Marahassi has been done, that the surveys after a bleaching event. So, you know, the water gets hot occasionally. It always has got hot. The corals have always bleached. The scientists fly over in their plane at, you know, 200 miles an hour and 150 metres or whatever, look down, and they think they can see the bleach. And you just can't. You just cannot do it. You've got to get into the water to really see it. You can't see the coral at depth. And remember, coral goes down to 50 metres. In many cases, you're lucky to see down just a few metres from the surface, and you certainly can't really see whether it's bleached. And then you've got to go back later and see whether the bleached coral died, which in most cases it won't die. All the latest data has suggested that we've had minimal coral loss from bleaching. So there's problems, again, with the survey methods they use. They're just so keen to try to demonstrate a disaster rather than doing proper science.
Just on that point of we can't be certain of what's going on with the reef, what about the other issues that could become quite a serious one? Is, I note a bit of a comment you made about potential new volcanic activity, which we know can create a winter circumstance for a very long time. where do we stand on that? I mean, we might as well put all the naughty things out on the table, because I don't think if people can hear this and listen to this podcast, then they might get a bit of a grasp on all the other facets that are around the issues, but not necessarily the ones they're being told.
One of the things that really worries me is that we're so fixated on the Great Barrier Reef and the climate change, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 degree increase in temperatures, though this is a disaster, especially if you live in Europe where you have 100 times more people die of cold than of heat, and they're worried about a 1 degree increase in temperature. It's just incredible. But what that has done is it's meant that we're taking our eye off some genuine issues. Now, in 1815, there was a huge volcanic eruption in Indonesia that essentially made it a degree or so cooler across the whole world. In Europe, they called it a winter without end because there was no proper summer. Crops failed. Now, that wasn't even the biggest sort of volcanic eruption you can get every 500 years. You go back in history, and there's been these occasions where a huge volcanic eruption could massively disrupt not just our supply chains, but our agriculture. And we're not ready for that. And these happen every few hundred years. Now, all right, we're unlikely to see it in our lifetime, but it is going to happen. It's a certainty that this is going to happen. Rapid climate change due to volcanic eruption. Now, we can prepare for it by making sure we store lots of food, but we're not doing that because we're worried about a 1 or 2 degree temperature rise, which is almost certainly beneficial to most agriculture, and the increase in carbon dioxide is certainly beneficial to agriculture. We're not worrying about bigger issues because we're worrying about things that actually we really shouldn't be worrying too much about.
Yeah, that's the madness. The things that are actually quite beneficial for everything that we're talking about are being demonized.
Well, it's crazy. All the data, for instance, there's satellites that have shown that have been going over the Earth looking at the greenness of the Earth, basically looking at leaves. And there's been a huge increase in greenery in sub-Saharan Africa, in Australia, exactly as the experiments would predict. If you have a 30 or 40% increase in carbon dioxide, the water utilization of plants dramatically improves. And in these dry, arid climates, plants grow way better. And you can do all sorts of estimates and measurements that wheat, I don't know the exact measurements, might be growing 10 or 20% faster because of all the extra carbon dioxide. So we should be looking at this as, all right, there may be some problems with carbon dioxide, but there are also some huge advantages. And the fact that those huge advantages are always ignored, this is a sort of an indication of why do they not tell us the whole story? Why are they just trying to bully us into the doom scenario by not mentioning the unequivocal good things from increasing carbon dioxide concentration?
Well, it's called brain fog, I think, Peter. Interesting enough, you know, I was always believed when I was very young that trees could not grow without carbon dioxide. Am I wrong about that?
No, absolutely right. I think the numbers, if you get below 180 parts per million, essentially almost no plants can live. Now, before the industrial era, in the last glacial period, 18,000 years ago, we were down at levels quite close to where, you know, a lot of plants will start to struggle. You know, the more carbon dioxide you got in the atmosphere, the better your plants are going to live. After all, the most important thing for a plant is water, followed by carbon dioxide. Those are the two things. And then you need little things like nitrogen and phosphorus. But basically, it's carbon dioxide and water. And more carbon dioxide will often mean plants will grow faster. And there's been just thousands of measurements. Why is it, for example, that in big greenhouses, they pump carbon dioxide into big greenhouses so that the plants grow faster?
Why don't the green people understand this?
Well, I think they. Well, it's a very good question, but why is it? I can understand a green who, you know, is very ideological and they're going to be selecting their evidence to suit their ideology. More importantly, why is it the scientific institution, the august institutions who I once would have believed without question, why is it they are ignoring all this data? Why is it that so many of our major institutions are now essentially corrupted, that we cannot trust them? This is a crying shame.
That's interesting you say that, Peter. Another interesting thing that I am very curious about is that As you well know, and this is, again, for the benefit of our international listeners, of which there are many, the North Queensland, Karen Benn was talking about this last week, is looking good. It's green, you know, and there must be a lot of carbon dioxide. The reef, according to her and to you, is not dying, as everybody would tell you. Why isn't our tourism industry, which relies very heavily on the greenery on the mainland up in the mountains, which looks apparently fantastic, and the Great Barrier Reef within a whistle's throw of places such as Townsville, where your old university is situated, why isn't the tourism industry jumping up and down and saying, we think that these people who are decrying everything are wrong?
Of course, it's not just me saying that the reef is wonderful. It's the Australian Institute of Marine Science data set, you know, that they've been doing for over 35 years, saying that we're at record or record equaling coral cover. Now, why doesn't the tourist industry do it? Well, you see, they are in a very tricky position because the last thing that they can say is, oh, the reef is fine, all this climate change stuff is wrong, because they actually rely on having a permit to go out to the reef to actually operate. So they've got to go along with the zeitgeist of the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority that the reef is, that the future is bleak about the reef. They sort of tread this really difficult tightrope act where they're trying to say, look, the reef is really, really good. You should come and see it. But, you know, we've got to do a whole lot to protect it for the future. So we've got to not burn carbon dioxide. So they're in a tricky position because they actually need to get a permit from the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority to actually take the tourists out to the reef.
Well, that's understandable, I suppose. But again, permits cost money, and money goes where?
To the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, yeah.
Well, it's a catch-22 situation, really, because one needs the money to operate, that is, keep all the hierarchy in their respective leather seats, and the tourism industry wants to get people on the boats in vinyl seats. And so how do you sort that out? Get them all together and say, this is actually the truth here, and you've got to get together and work it out.
I think you're going back to point one here, Mike, where Dr. Ritt has spoken to all the politicians, and there's plenty of them that understand that there's a load of codswallop happening here, but they're not prepared to stand up and discuss it. And then the tourism operators, by the sounds of it, are being a little bit careful, and I'll use the word gutless, in standing up to probably a quangotic authority that appears to be telling pork pies. So we've got a bit of a mess.
As usual, Richard, you're right again. That's the difference between a politician and a parliamentarian.
Well, exactly. You're dead right. And by the way, it's not only the tourist industry that has been very gutless, though they are better now. I think they can see that eventually they're going to have to stand up. The agricultural industry has, up to a few years ago, been even worse, and because agriculture is supposedly claimed to be killing the reef, as you had Karen Benn on the other day. Let me give you some figures on that.
Please do.
Right. So, for example, pesticides from farms are supposedly killing the reef, and yet when you measure the pesticides out on the reef with the most ultra sensitive scientific equipment, down to parts per trillion level, right? They're below detection limits. You can't even measure them. That's how trivial the concentrations are, right? And supposedly the how can the farmers be killing the reef when you can't even find them?
You can't even find what they've done. Well,
no.
See, and this is what is so bloody frustrating to a layperson like myself. When you put this in front of me, Dr. Karen Baird did it, other people who are going there say it's all fine, and yet we've got this huge smokescreen of lies and obfuscation and fear-mongering. It's got to be just said, no, put it back in your kit and let's be a bit honest here somewhere. But we've got it in every facet of life at the moment, unfortunately, Peter. So I can't believe you can't even find the chemical that's killing the reef. You know, Dr. Benn made the same observation. It's a non-existent thing. So, you know, how do we start standing up and pointing out to people worldwide that there's a scam going on. You've been punished for standing up and being decent and honest, and we've got a problem.
Well, again, it comes down to how you make a chink in this, basically a scientific mafia that's formed that will exclude And it is. It's genuinely like a scientific marker. You step out of line, you'll be kneecapped. Simple as that. Why do you think it is that Karen Bean is now able to speak? Because she's left science. I decided that I would take the risk of being fired. I knew that that was almost certainly going to happen to me a few years before it happened, because I was towards the end of my career and it didn't matter, right?
Right.
So the mafia could do what they like. So as I said before, the way we get into this is we just ask for quality assurance. And on this account, we've actually got the scientific community on our side in a perverse fashion, because there's this thing called the replication crisis, where it is now well known that about 50% of the peer-reviewed scientific literature that's come out just recently, you know, the last 20 years, right, is wrong, right? So this is now well known in the biomedical fields, in psychology, education, even in engineering. A huge percentage of the scientific literature is wrong because peer review doesn't work as a quality assurance system. Now, you go to the Australian Academy of Sciences and they'll say, yeah, we know about the replication crisis. We're doing various things about it. And you say, well, do you think it might have got into Great Barrier Reef science? Oh, no. It wouldn't be there. Now, this is ridiculous, okay? Mm. If it's in biomedical, it's going to be in areas where there's ideology. So we've actually got a situation where we need to just point out to the scientific fraternity and the politicians that they are admitting that there is a quality assurance problem in the whole of science, and that a politician just asking for a bit more quality assurance, let's just start in the environmental sciences, makes a lot of sense in terms of what the scientific institutions are saying. And it also makes just a common sense to the average voter that, of course, there's a possibility there's a bit of ideology there. Of course, we should do a little bit more checking and just to see what's actually true or not. So that's the way I think we should get into it.
Peter, we've got some more points to raise with you. We're going to have to go to a break any moment, I think. So it might be a good idea to come back shortly. We've got some more time.
We have 5 minutes.
That's wonderful. Very what I was going to ask you was, it relates to the number of reefs in the whole world, not just on the northeast coast of Australia. There are some fabulous reefs in other parts of the world, so I'm told, and you'd be more aware of them than I. Are they a bit set with the same problems and criticism as the Great Barrier Reef is?
To some extent, they are. Some of the reefs around the world are genuinely stressed. I mean, if you've got a population in, say, in the Caribbean of 50 million people living very close to reefs, you know, that's going to stress them more than on the Great Barrier Reef, where we don't even have a million people on a similar size reef system.
Yeah.
But actually, when you look at the data from around the world, a lot of the reefs around the world look to be doing pretty well, just like the Great Barrier Reef. Their main threat is overfishing, genuine overfishing. That does not happen on the Great Barrier Reef. You know, dynamite fishing, for instance, that can never be good for a reef. Yeah, there's some fabulous reefs around the world. Some of those close to big population centres are definitely stressed. But by and large, you know, reefs are doing okay, especially if you take that just genuine huge people pressure off them. And the Great Barrier Reef has never had significant amount of people pressure on it.
But you're talking about influences which do not run along the lines of people arguing for climate change. You're talking about other influences, such as too many people going to the reefs and probably diving and snorkeling and all that sort of thing.
Well, taking fish, you know, fishing on the reef. You know, yeah. In a lot of these reefs, they'll take every fish right down to just a few centimetres in size. This is real exploitation of a resource. That doesn't happen on the Great Barrier Reef. But there is an interesting difference, say, between I've seen the Israelis. The Israelis have reefs in hot water that's way hotter than on the Great Barrier. It gets up to almost 40 degrees. You know, this is incredibly hot water. They're only small reefs, but they're very close to Europe and they're very important for their tourist industry. And they will, rather than run down their reef system like our government and our scientists do, our scientists say, oh, the reef is terrible, you know, it's endangered and all the rest of it, scares away the tourists. The Israelis will say, well, our reefs seem to be coping pretty well with this climate change. They're wonderful. And, of course, that's going to be good for their tourist industry. And you wonder why in Australia, we're doing so much damage to our number one tourist attraction, the Great Barrier Reef.
How much damage is done by natural events as well, such as hurricanes and cyclones? I think we raised this with Karen last program.
That's the number one thing. There was a big cyclone called Tropical Cyclone Hamish, 2010. The track of the cyclone was just, you couldn't have drawn a track better to kill more coral, right? It was a big cyclone, went straight down the central and southern part of the reef, and it actually halved the amount of coral, essentially in about 2 days. It took 6 to 7 years to recover from that. That was the biggest thing by far. Forget bleaching, forget crown of thorns, starfish. That one cyclone was utterly devastating. Now, the cyclones are no worse than they ever used to be, but those natural things which occur on the reef, that they kill coral, but it recovers. And the fact that it recovers so quickly is indicative of a very, very resilient, healthy ecosystem.
I've got a little query here, Mike, if I can put it in, but we've got to go to a break. But I'll just pose the effects of the ocean warming. But what's Peter's observation of all the climate modelling? Because it doesn't appear to be very good either. But we'll go to the break and perhaps come back on that point, if I may.
Misty Winston on today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Yesterday, supporters of journalist and publisher Julian Assange gathered in Canberra for a rally on the lawns outside Parliament House. During that event, Dr. Robert Marr, spokesman for the group Australian Doctors for Assange, warned that the political prisoner is in very real danger medically. Quote, medical examinations of Julian Assange in Belmarsh Prison in the UK have revealed that he is suffering from severe, life-threatening cardiovascular and stress-related medical conditions, including having a mini-stroke as a result of his imprisonment and psychological torture, end quote. Andrew Wilkie, independent MP and longtime supporter, also addressed the crowd, stating, quote, the U.S. wants to get even, and for so long, the U.K. and Australia have been happy to go along for the ride because they've put bilateral relationships with Washington ahead of the rights of a decent man, end quote. The WikiLeaks founder has now been held in Belmarsh Prison, also known as the Guantanamo Bay of the U.K., for 1,204 days. The future of press freedom and free speech sits alongside him in his cell. This is Misty Winston for TNT Radio.
Are you finding it harder to do the things you used to do, like vacuuming or getting to appointments? If you need a bit of support at home, the Australian Government's My Aged Care is your starting point to access services. You'll find all the information and advice you need in the one place. To find out about other services, eligibility and costs, call 1800 200 422 or go to myagedcare.gov.au. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra, spoken by Heather Christie.
Government Today.
They're not human. They ought to be destroyed.
It's like all the children from the Village of the Damned grew up and went into politics.
You can't stop us, you know.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And here we are on Politically Incorrect with our very special guest, Dr. Peter Ridd. Richard, as you know, I'm in a very special place today. I'm actually broadcasting from Studio 602. So I want to thank my hosts for allowing me to be there. You were going to ask Dr. Ridd some interesting questions.
Well, I don't know if they're interesting, but I was just, Dr. Ridd's got a lot of data, a lot of background and everything. And there's modelling and modelling and modelling. And one of those things that is modelled is the climate or the weather or whatever we want to call it. I just call it a change in the weather, but that's another matter. But how accurate the modelling appears to be as wonky as everything else that's happening around him.
The climate modelling is essentially not fit for purpose. It doesn't give a useful prediction. I can go into that. I mean, there's so many reasons why it just doesn't work, which is a bit of a problem because it means that we're not really sure what the doubling in carbon dioxide will do. You can do a simple calculation, which is probably every bit as good as the big complicated models, which would indicate doubling of carbon dioxide would make a 1, 1.5, maybe 2 degree increase in temperature. That's not dangerous. That's not a cataclysm. And we've got bigger fish to fry than that.
So a lot of conclusions are being drawn and steps taken that are being based on very, very bad a structure of advice or whatever you want to call it. So we're doing things from the wrong premise.
Well, exactly. And again, this this is a real problem, because we have the scientific institutions who are pushing these models, and they really should know better. They should know, because these models have been running, you know, for the best part of 40 years, and they've been continuously over-predicting how much the world will warm by, and they've been continuously shown to be far too hot. You know, they're getting hot by about double what they should do. They're ignoring the historical record, which shows that if you go back 1,000 years ago, it was almost certainly every bit as warm as it was now. If you go back to the period when the Egyptians were building pyramids, it was 1 or 2 degrees hotter than it is now. There was no carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So why do they keep on placing all the emphasis on carbon dioxide? And why do they keep on trusting these models when they know that the models do not account for water vapor, cloud formation, and 101 other things particularly accurately?
Well, Peter, that's where the problem's arising, is the majority of people don't have your scope or knowledge of the whole process. And therefore, they become, especially the younger generation, confused and frightened about things that really have no reason for frightening them. And then we go off with policy from government, and then the great unknown one is then we throw money at it and there's a few people get the benefit.
I think brainwashing comes to mind, Richard.
That's certainly part of it.
But well, the brainwashing is the most worrying thing, especially in schools. I mean, one thing I'm doing with the IPA the most is I'm trying to get to the younger generation through a program called Reef Rebels, where we're taking young people out to the reef and showing them, you know, you've been told the reef is a complete disaster. Here it is. Does it look like a disaster? Let's have a look at some data. This does not look like disaster. We've got a record coral cover. But, of course, the curriculum in schools is just, it's just continuous brainwashing in a very large number of things. So it's not surprising that a huge percentage of the West's youth is completely depressed about it. Yes. But I actually think that might be where salvation will come, because once that generation who have been brainwashed realised that this was untrue, they could get very angry very quickly and the whole shibboleth would come tumbling down very rapidly.
What if it's too late, Peter?
Well, that's the worry. It needs to happen in the next 5 years. We're doing so much damage to our economies. And there's other economies who are just ignoring this, and they are overtaking us in so many different fields.
That's a good point. And from a science point of view, you'd know this, wouldn't you, that so much money is being thrown at all the arguments that are just wrong, according to you at least, and many more.
Well, plenty of others are saying so too, Mike. It's not
exactly.
Well, the evidence is demonstrating it's wrong. I mean, you don't need to listen to me. You just need to look at the data on the coral cover of the Great Barrier Reef. We're at record high coral cover. You know, that should be the end of the story. But you do see that we in the West, we've just got so much money is being spent on things which are not just, you wouldn't mind if it was just wasted, but this is actually doing tangible damage. Whereas the Chinese are spending money on, you know, they're going to the moon. They're going to go to, but you know, metaphorically and physically, they're going to go ahead while we worry about things which we shouldn't be worrying about. You know, maybe we should say good luck to the Chinese. They deserve it because they haven't gone crazy.
They haven't been on the moon yet, though, have they? Or have they?
Maybe
not yet, but they will be very shortly.
Yeah. Speaking of the Chinese, a thing that I was concerned about. I don't know whether this is up your alley, but Peter, what's this business about? What's this business about rising, not tides, rising sea levels? Is that caused by the heat of the sun or what?
The main reason that is claimed is the if you heat seawater, it expands, and they're also claiming there's a bit of melting of the ice caps. Look, yeah. The sea level rise is a couple of millimetres a year at most, right? So over 100 years, over 150 years, you'll get 30 centimetres or 1 foot of sea level rise. Now, again, that is not a cataclysm. Yeah, this isn't half of Sydney's going to be underwater or something crazy like this. It's a very, very gentle, slow rise. Again, we shouldn't be, you know, it's something to keep in mind, you know, 1 foot over 150 years, yeah, but it's not the end of the world.
It doesn't seem to have affected Venice over many, many years. The tourists still go there, even if they walk across the canals on planks.
And, of course, the main problem with Venice is that it's actually sinking.
That's
and
your
there's
problem.
Lots of parts of the world where the land is sinking. That's the problem. And Venice now is protected by the barriers. Now they've had a few glitches with those barriers, but that will do much more to keep Venice safe than anything else. And the same in London, you know. They've had some horrific storms over the centuries, but London is now protected by the Thames barrages. So there are things you can do to, you know, mitigate the 30-centimetre rise in sea level that's going to happen over 150 years, and that will be much cheaper, much, much, much cheaper than destroying your economy by building windmills.
Holland's been doing it pretty well for a while.
Precisely, and they're sinking, you know, and there's lots of other places that are, have a similar sort of problem.
And that's, you know, sometimes the thing's blowing out of proportion, because we've got a gentleman who's, you know, done a lot of work in with ports all around the world, and there's records he's seen for about 140 years, and the best numbers he comes up with is a couple of millimetres up or down, if at all. So it's a very curious one. We'll run out of time talking to you, unfortunately. We'll have to get you back. But the art of free speech, that'd be something pretty dear to your heart. It's becoming non-existent, along with a totally compromised media. In our last few minutes, do you want to make a bit of an observation what they've done to you in that guise of ordinariness?
Well, I mean, my court case was about free speech, and as I said, the High Court actually said the university acted unlawfully, but then perversely said my work contract said they were able to stop me talking about their, because of the confidentiality clause, that they were able to stop me talking about their unlawful activity. So it's a bit crazy. I'm a little bit more optimistic than I was a couple of years ago on the free speech thing.
Good.
If you look at what's going on in America and also what's going on in the UK, I'm a member of a thing called the Free Speech Union, and there are definitely some good things happening in the UK where even politicians are now starting to say, you know, we've got to have free speech. People have just got to, you know, man up, and if somebody says something you don't like, argue with it rather than
debate.
You know, say I got offended or something like that. So yeah. I'm a bit more optimistic.
Okay, well, that's good. I unfortunately have sort of stopped buying and taking any notice of what I call the mainstream media here in Australia, because too much of it is pushing absolute rubbish, and there's no counter. If you want to ring up and have a comment, and you can try it if you want to, with the ABC and saying, look, I'm taking issue with what you're telling, you just won't be put on. And that's
I agree.
And that's sad.
Look, I can tell you some stories about the ABC.
I bet you can.
You have both just ruined my day mentioning the ABC.
Let him go.
The ABC, to be fair, was very good on the free speech aspect of my court case. They actually reported it. But I know that the journalists have been told, you will not listen, you will not report Peter Ridd's view on the Great Barrier Reef. I was told that by an ABC journalist, so it's come down from the top. So I've been trying to get a guy, one of the main ABC journalists, to report this fabulous coral cover and say, you've got a duty to tell your viewers that the reef has got record high coral cover, and why don't you do it? And I keep throwing the bait at them. Eventually they may come round, but essentially they have decided, no, the reef is dead. We will not put the other side of the argument on. There is no argument. This is the truth.
So they know everything now, do they?
Exactly. They think they know everything. And they
should
think
remember that they're using taxpayers' money to exist.
Exactly. So what they should do is they should have me on for a little bit and say, this is what he says, and then they should have the Australian Institute of Marine Science trying to argue that, well, their figures don't show that they're at record high coral cover, even though they are. And then the viewer can make up their own mind. They can even say Peter Ridd is a maverick, but most of his colleagues don't agree with him. That's fine. But they have a duty to show both sides of the argument. It's not like I'm some sort of, you know, loon who's never worked on the Great Barrier Reef. I've worked on the Great Barrier Reef since 1984. I've got a lot of publications. I may be wrong, obviously, but they have a duty to show both sides of an argument, where in many cases you will have a minority that end up in the end being right.
Well, we could bash the ABC all day and night. You know that's the case. But what about the press?
Exactly the same, except for, with the exception of The Australian, which does report both sides of the argument on the reef. There's almost no other newspaper at all that will do that. So, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's electronic or paper or whatever. The whole of the mainstream media, more or less, 90% of it is a disaster area. And that's why I guess we're talking tonight, eh?
Well, Peter, speaking of talking tonight, it's been great to have you on the show. Richard, you've nailed a great piece of talent here with Dr. Peter Ridd. And I've got to say, we're going to have to get you back. We've got a lot more to talk about, I'm sure. What do you think, Richard?
Well, if he's well prepared to come back and put up with you and I, that'd be wonderful.
We've only got a few seconds for him to refute that idea. Good night, Peter. Thanks again.
I'd love to come back. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Peter. Bye-bye.